Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, and art. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here with always with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello to everybody. We're here for the last interview of Can We Design a Slum-Friendly City? So after hearing Urban Think Tank and Gunj, we're finally speaking today with Himanshu Parikh, a phenomenal engineer that actually had very strong ideas and a very strong impact on how a slum can actually be restored through engineering.
Yeah, he's the originator of a concept called slum networking, and has some very interesting and groundbreaking ideas about how cities originate organically. And, you know, the systems of a city, looking at, you know, medieval London or something like that, follow a certain sort of topography and that sort of thing. And slums can be improved by acknowledging and exploring the sort of natural topography, the natural systems of a city.
So I was really impressed by speaking with Parikh. Well, of course, he won tons of prizes. He won a United Nations World Habitat Award for his practice, an Aga Khan Award. So he's extremely well recognized. I sometimes have a hard time to see, you know, the human face on engineering, but he found a way. And I think what was really interesting is that he found a way in which slum dwellers were becoming partners with government and industries to, in fact, do a new engineering plan of a slum, and through this actually start a larger development. But what was interesting was that this allowed slum dwellers to partner with government, and so access to land tenure and access to a relation that otherwise they would completely miss.
And I think that concept of partnership is so critical, not only in his work, but in any work of this kind. I was really blown away, and you'll hear it in the interview, where he's breaking down the mathematics of foreign aid. And at some point, I think he says that if you totaled up all the foreign aid budgets of every government in the world, it would still only address 5% of the needs of the world. So how can we get away from this idea of aid and charity and start building true community partnerships that leverage the human capital that always exists in slums?
Yes, I really think that Parikh is a crucial interview to listen to if you're looking at development of informal settlements. So let's listen to the interview.
Himanshu, welcome to the show. We're very honored to have you here to talk with our listeners about your work. We're wondering if you could start us off with the origins of slum networking and your practice and how it is you came to do what you do.
I actually grew up in London, then did my engineering at Cambridge, and then practiced in Cambridge for about 10 years as a structural engineer. And I went to India for a year or two just to do something different. When I went to India and I started working on structures, I realized that infrastructure there is so poor that I should be able to get into that. If one can do structures, one can also do infrastructure. It's all civil engineering. And so I sort of slowly started getting into infrastructure. And then I got invited by DFID for a large slum infrastructure development project that they had in a city of India. They invited me because I think they thought that structural engineer is the same thing as infrastructure engineer. So that's how I got invited to it. It was something totally new for me, but it was, as an engineer, I find it very, very exciting. I love engineering. And so that's how I started getting into infrastructure for slums. That particular project had about 100 slum settlements and a population of about 500,000 people. The stock thing to do in slums, and even now this is the case, is that you see it as a mess, you clean it up, and then you build this sort of housing blocks, which are all stereotype. Because I was sort of new into the field and I didn't have any preconceived notions, I started thinking about it and I thought, hang on, if you start building housing for all the people, we don't have the resources. If you look at the present statistics, for example, about 1.5 billion people in the world live in slums. And in spite of huge government intervention globally now, that population is likely to increase to about 3 billion people in the next 30 years. So the first issue was cleaning up the mess, and building housing is not the right solution. Then the next thing that I realized when I started working the slum story was that if you work on infrastructure, which is basically doing roads, water, sanitation, storm drainage, landscaping, those kind of things. In other words, everything other than the housing, I started realizing that people themselves started changing their own housing. What happened was that when I saw that project 10 years down the road, the housing that, that people had built was better than the kind of public housing that you'd get provided by the government. The cost of infrastructure is 1/20th of that of building a house. So in other words, at the investment, which was 1/20th of building a house, I actually eventually got a house, right? So that's how the whole idea of slum networking developed, that there are huge hidden potential resources amongst people we consider poor, which we don't generally tap. That's one idea. The second one is that if we demolish slums and build something there instead, no government has the resources to do it. For example, if you take the total aid budget which is available, I don't mean government budget, but the aid budget, which is United Nations, World Bank, DFID, Japanese International Bank, all those put together, the amount of money that they have will serve 5% of the resource need for just developing the infrastructure for the poor in the world. 5%.
Wow.
Which means that 95% just for infrastructure has to be obtained from somewhere else. The second idea of slum networking is that if you have to generate 95% from somewhere else, then why look at aid in the first place? In other words, get away from this aid concept, because aid is not sustainable. And so Indore was a British government aid project. The subsequent work I started doing, I dispensed with aid altogether and realized that already looking at the experience of Indore, that if people can spend a fair amount of money building their own houses, they have hidden money somewhere. And so what I started doing in the next set of projects was without aid, to actually approach the slum dwellers, convince them that they do have the money, that infrastructure is something they cannot do, because house is something you can build yourself. Infrastructure of a settlement requires planning at the settlement level or a town level. And I started convincing them that, look, if you just do infrastructure, it doesn't cost you a lot of money. Why don't you put in a little bit of your own money? Then I went to government and said that, look, you have this huge amount of money for housing. At 1/20th of the cost of that, you can actually provide housing to the people. Why don't you become one of the partners? And the little bonus is that slum dwellers themselves will also be part capital partners. So your resource need goes down even further. Then I went to industry, local industry, and said that, look, these first few slums that I'm working in are around your industry, and most of the workers are actually working in your industries. Why don't you also become a capital partner? And the amount is so small, because you're talking about just infrastructure cost, which is 1/20th the housing cost. And if you have to pay, again, as industry just said, 20 or 30% contribution, it's a tiny amount. And I convinced them that it's actually less than your annual advertising budget. And what better advertising do you have than to say that XYZ industry cares, with huge hoardings and all those things, okay? That's the sort of second set of development, that I started using the internal resources and developed partnership. The partnership we generally develop is 1/3 of the infrastructure cost coming from the slum dwellers, 1/3 coming from the government, and 1/3 coming from the business sector or industry or corporates or whatever you want to call it, okay? So that's the second concept. The third concept that I realized, and probably that's again because I was new to the field, and I don't advocate ignorance as the best way of doing a project, but at the same time, if you're new to the project, you also don't suffer from preconceived notions, and you can think fresh. And one thing that I noticed when I was working in the city of Indore on the DFID project, which was a citywide project, in fact, there are two things I realized. This is now engineering, okay? And the two things that I realized, the first one was that if you look at all the slums in that city, they all hug the rivers and the ponds and the creeks and things like that, okay? Now, there are several reasons for that, because that's a sort of kind of marginal land which doesn't belong to anyone. That may be one of the reasons. The other reason for that is because then they have access to water from the river or the pond or the creek or whatever it is. And for sanitation, they just go and defecate down the riverbank, okay? I found that very interesting relationship. And then when I studied all the other cities in the world, I found exactly the same picture emerging, where it's Cairo, where it's Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. London also has the same thing, that you find very poor settlements in London around the river or the streams, okay?
Okay.
That was one very interesting idea. The other very interesting idea was this notion that I realized that, look, all the cities drain themselves naturally. A lot of people will say, how do you reach that conclusion? And the idea is very, very simple. If the cities in today's world don't have the capacity to drain naturally, a village would not have turned into a town, and a town would not have turned into a city, because the initial development started before electricity came in. If you look at any present day city, their origins were before electricity came in, okay?
So the natural evolution of the city is to develop settlements around these natural topographies for drainage.
That's right. In fact, the London sewerage was nothing more than they actually put pipes in the existing streams and then filled them up, because the streams were the natural part into which all the water drained. If there was any low-lying area, it wouldn't have developed and grown into a city, because it would be flooded all the time. Those two things, that first of all, cities have natural topography, which is actually conducive to your sewer lines, water supply, all working with gravity without any pumping. And so in the modern city, if you do have very deep sewer lines and huge pumping stations and all that, people have forgotten that you're not working with the topography, because technology has now freed us. But at the same time, you know, we've forgotten certain very positive facts about the topography of a city. So what happened in Indore, the first settlement we did, was that instead of the conventional slum solutions, because even if you do water and sanitation, the standard solution is that you do a public latrine. Instead of that, we actually built up proper infrastructure networks of storm drainage, water supply, sewerage, all running with topography, so there is no pumping involved, all going into the streams eventually. And we found that the main lines along the stream, if you make them a little larger than the slum need, in fact, the rest of the city can start draining into it. So the slums, instead of becoming a liability in the city, because they are interconnected and along the natural drainage paths, can actually help to build up infrastructure networks for the city, which serve the rest of the city, okay? So that's the third concept, that's the engineering concept. So these are the three things around which my work revolves. Subsequently, I sort of realized, as we studied this thing further and further and further and collected more and more documents, that if you look at several different ways of intervening in slums, there could be hundreds of ways you can intervene in slums. You can intervene through, I've used infrastructure as a mechanism, but one could have used education perhaps to change things, or one could have used housing to change things, or one could have used health to change things, or one could have used sort of better governance to change things. The important thing about infrastructure is that there's nothing cheaper or faster than infrastructure to actually change health, incomes, and education standards in slums.
And what sort of improvements in health outcomes and education outcomes have you seen through your work?
For example, the minute you introduce sewerage network in the slums with individual toilets, the infant mortality rate dropped in the slums that we had observed from about 2.2% to 1% in just 2 years' time. It's halving the infant mortality rate in just 2 years' time. Can you imagine that? That kind of change normally through any other process, through either health or education, would take 20 to 30 years. Another example, incomes. The minute infrastructure was introduced in these slums, within 2 years, the income of every household increased by almost 60 to 70%.
Wow.
Can you imagine, for example, any governance measures or any banking measures or any budgeting measures or any other intervention, health, education, whatever it is, which can increase incomes by 60 to 70% in 2 years' time?
That's impressive, and it really shows how infrastructure can become a tool of legitimation of the slum dwellers in their own neighborhood. So basically, people, once they understand they have permanent ownership, they become, I mean, if I understood well your story, they become directly investors in their own neighborhood. And this really shows how infrastructure is, in fact, the empowerment tool. We're taking a short break now, just to give us time to sink in this exceptional information. We will be back soon to hear Himanshu Parikh's engineering and mediation process and to understand better how to upgrade an informal settlement from within. This is Social Design Insights. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation thus far. We know that Himanshu has laid out an intimidating scale of problems in the first half. And moving forward, we're going to dive right back in, and you'll hear as Himanshu explains the social systems behind the engineering and how improvements require a form of representative democracy built entirely in the slum, a common theme among many of our honorees. Listen close, because he also goes through a great discussion of how to involve government, which Himanshu sees as an equal partner, not just for political expediency, but because it makes for a more stable community and begins to blur the line between the formal and the informal. Let's jump back in.
But Himanshu, when you talk about infrastructure in this case that can increase income and commerce, you mean also changing plan of the streets and the circulation and these kind of things? Or is it only actually having a hidden infrastructure in terms of sewage and electric infrastructure?
No, we don't change planet to the maximum extent possible. So we take an existing layout, and within that, we actually put in water supply, sewerage, storm drainage, roads, street lighting, and then solid waste management, so community dustbins and things like that, and keep the layout almost as close to the original as possible, except that in occasional cases, just to actually give some through roads or better vehicular access, we may have to move, shift some of the shacks around and sort of widen odd roads here and there. For us, that became very easy in our later models when the slum dwellers were the partners, because they knew that it was in their own benefit that all these things were happening. And we're working with slum dweller community as a group because they were a capital partner. So they were actually in the decision making as well.
At the beginning, it must be really difficult to convince people, because I'm sure that after you have the effect, you have a direct impact. But did you use a mediation of local organizations to convince people? Or was it simply through the charisma of an idea of improvement that brought forward this project?
No, there are two things we did. One was obviously the improvement that better infrastructure would bring. And it's not just charisma. The people in slums know exactly how precious having water and sanitation is. So they value that commodity quite a lot. So that was A, convincing. But secondly, because the slum dwellers themselves became partners to the project, how does one become a partner? I mean, there's a slum with 3,000 people. I'm not going to go to all the 3,000 people, convince each one of them, receive their monthly contribution and all that. So the structure that we organized, that each slum would elect its own representative committee, and we have dialogue with that committee. So I have now established a channel of communication. And so it is a committee which is told that, look, we can give you this kind of infrastructure, but there are a couple of places here where it's very difficult either to get the road in or to connect my drain pipe across to the riverbank or whatever it is. And you have a choice. Either you have something very substandard, or you as a community decide that five of the houses, they're basically shacks, they'd be shifted a little bit. And you as a group reach a decision and tell me what to do. So I had established that kind of structure and channel of communication, if you see what I mean.
And have the slum dwellers been able to remain autonomous in these sorts of decision, the mapping and the decisions of where infrastructure goes? That's internal to the slum community, correct?
Yeah, but the point is that because they're a capital partner, anything that I do has to have their consent.
Hmm.
It's like you getting a house on mortgage. You know, you have a choice as to what house you want, what you can afford.
But this also comes with a problem because, I mean, some of these communities do not have land tenure, right? So in that case, it would also be difficult to have them as partners because this would give them a specific authority on the land that they're staying on, they're living on.
That is exactly the reason why I made government one third of the partner, because it's not their money that I needed. Of the substantial cost, if only one third is going to come from the government, it's a very, very tiny amount. The inducement for the government is that at a much lesser cost, they can serve a much larger number of people, one. Secondly, it makes the government very popular. But the inducement for me was that if government is also a partner to the project, then the legal and the administrative framework which constrains development can be put into place. And so we actually persuaded the government, and in fact, it's already under the, when we work in India, it's already under the Constitution of India, that a family which can prove that it has been established in a place for X number of time and has documents to show that cannot be forcibly evicted. Now, with government as being one of the partners, eviction of these families was now totally out of the question for two reasons. Firstly, because these families are not officially part of the scheme, which means that they pay the rates to the government, they have official electricity connections, so they have tax bills which show that they've been staying in this place for a while. And the other thing was that because government was one of the partners, it is then difficult for the government to actually then eradicate slums and erase them, because then they're destroying their own investment. So one of the reasons for making government a partner, it's not the easiest partner because, you know, one is dealing with bureaucracy and all those things, but it is at the same time essential. The third reason government partnership is also essential is because of all the other partners, it's only the government partner which is the democratic sanctity. So if I go despotic and I say, no, I'll do this or that or the other, who is to stop me? But if government does something like that, they won't be elected in the next election, okay? So it gave me the, you know, authorization for doing the whole thing, security of tenure, because we found that the reason slum dwellers actually do have a lot of hidden resources, and especially if they're better sanitation, then they have even more incomes, lesser expenses on medical, less time wasted collecting water, so more earning hours and all those things. But in spite of that, the reason they don't improve their housing is because they're afraid of tenure, because their housing may be demolished. But if government is involved and they give tenure as part of their role, then the security is established. So tenure is very, very important. And that is why government, in our case, had to be an essential partner, although a difficult partner to work with.
But in this sense, I mean, you're somehow creating a paradigmatic change, because it's really an idea that development of informal settlement comes with this kind of an alliance between three important components: government, slum dwellers, and even businesses that profit from these communities of workers. So somehow it seems like a perfect solution. Was this kind of approach then implemented in a certain legislation? Was it developed further?
Yes, because when we started working to larger settlements, the partnership which was set up, for example, with the municipal corporation, that partnership would be a written partnership with an agreement. All the terms and conditions would then be passed by the elected members of the municipality. So it gets its legal sanctity.
Besides this first experiment and successful experiment in Indore, was it taken as an example for future development?
The Indore experiment was full grant funding, okay? So all these other ideas of forming partnerships, involving governments, people building their own housing and all that was not Indore. That was all the subsequent projects that I did, which were all done without aid. Then subsequently from Indore, then I worked into cities of, in slums of Ahmedabad, a city in India where I lived, and other cities of India as well. And then eventually I took that idea further and started working in villages of India.
To amplify Emiliano's question a little bit, how has all of these partnerships changed the relationship between the slum and the more formal areas of the city? You had spoken earlier about how the slum becomes part of the drainage infrastructure of the city. Have you noticed a change in the cultural relationship or the social dynamic between the formal and the informal?
Yes, I have. Well, there are two or three very interesting aspects. Normally what used to happen is that if a slum was demolished and government housing was provided, you'd find that if you went there 10 years down the road, 60 to 70% of the families would have moved out again and sold their houses because it's quick profit, and they go and live back in the slums. Whereas in the slums that we worked in, we found that although the housing is improved to very high standards, after 10 years, you find that almost 80% of the original population is still remaining there. So that's one very interesting thing. In other words, people are now committed. So that's sort of one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it also is that this just last 5 years or so that I've started seeing another change happening, that after building this sort of nice two-story houses, most people have done, some of the local residents, like group of 10 or 15 houses, would get together. They've just started doing it, so I don't know how viable it is. And they said that, look, we'll demolish all our houses together, and instead of that, build a block of flats in which we live, which is of even higher standards. It's, the slums are looking more and more like a normal city, if you see what I mean, okay?
Mm.
There's also a third argument, and that's a very important argument, because a lot of people say that, well, city is a high-priced land, and these are all these illegal people who are squatted in that. What right do they have? Why don't we shift them outside the city and make use of this very precious land? There are philosophical arguments against it and practical arguments as well. The philosophical argument is that, do you want a city which is divided by rich and poor? So poor live in one part, rich in another part, or do you want a better mix of people? Or do you want a city which is divided so that, you know, all the Christians live in one area because they can't get along with Muslims who live in different area, who can't get along with Hindus which live in the third area? Or do you want an integrated city? So that's the kind of philosophical argument coming behind it. The practical argument in the working argument also is that slums generally happen in parts of the city. It's not just a question of useless land, but slums generally happen in parts of the city which are very closely connected to trading. So you'll find the slums generally happen around marketplaces, slums generally happen around railway stations. The reason is because the workforce which fuels the urban economy is actually living in these areas, and this is living close to the workplaces is convenient. Now, if you are going to clean all this mess up and shift them to the limits of the city, then they don't have the same access to their workplace. So in other words, the city needs this workforce in its heart for the benefit of city's economy as much as slum dwellers need to be close to their work. You see the economic argument as well.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a fundamental principle, because displacing people breaks completely their economic connections to the city where they live, and also their social connection. So it's, of course, an extremely disruptive effect.
And if you think about it, if you're going to shift people outside, then you have to build new infrastructure for them. You have to build connecting roads for them. You can actually, within the city, start improving the city.
Exactly. And I think, you know, what makes it also interesting is that is this more than remaking a city, that is a concept that seems very abstract and coming from top down. This is an idea of empowering local population to, in fact, progressively improve using infrastructure and then small commerce to become basically formal from the informal situation where they started. That is probably how many European cities and other cities around the world that, you know, developed through centuries progressively were uplifted by their you know, progressive evolution and change.
Exactly. And now the most recent example of that is London. East London was really run down, a lot of vandalism there, very poor families lived there, housing stock was extremely poor. And what the British government did very, very smartly was that during the last Olympics, which were held in London, they used the Olympic budget to start improving infrastructure of East London. And suddenly, East London, which was like, you know, the low income, working class, poor area kind of thing, suddenly the quality of that area has changed very, very dramatically. So renewal from within, I think, is always better than sort of cleaning up and starting again.
I think that's a very powerful statement and a powerful place to close. I think that how we've regarded slums historically has often taken the form of a bulldozer, and the approach has been to level things and gentrify. So it's optimistic to hear about these strategies that propose an alternative that allows people to improve their own spaces and celebrates the connection between the formal and the informal in a city. Emiliano, did you want to offer a last question or some closing thoughts?
I just wanted to thank Himanshu. I think it's been tremendously interesting to speak with you. It was, of course, also tremendously ambitious to bring all these topics in such a short interview, but I hope we'll have the chance to talk about it more thoroughly in the future.
The only thing I can say to end is that the work that I've done, for example, has changed lives of about 500,000 people, and I have no money in my pocket. You know, for a person who has very little resources, I'm not rich, to be able to change lives of 500,000 people very dramatically, it can't be such a bad strategy.
Absolutely.
I think we're right there with you.
At least in the second part.
Yeah. Himanshu, it's been a great pleasure and an honor to speak with you.
Lovely.
Good luck for your projects in the future, and we'll certainly be in touch soon.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We'd like to thank our guest of the week, Himanshu Parikh, for sharing with us his insights into how to create a slum-friendly city. Conservatively, a quarter of the world's population lives in slums, and that number is growing. For the sake of our shared humanity, we have to find a better way, and thinkers like Parikh are at the vanguard. To learn more about Himanshu's work, please visit our website at currystonedesignprize.com. There you'll find galleries of his work, narrative histories, and a few links to further your research. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for all the latest news on social impact design.